On this jam-packed episode of Baseball Barbacast, we interviewed Cal Ripken. I could tell you more about the podcast, which included conversation about the schedule release and Garrett Crochet and Jonah Tong and the Women's Professional Baseball League and like 10 minutes on Taylor Swift. But we got to interview Cal Ripken. So that's like, it's pretty sweet. And you can listen to it right now. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce should have gotten engaged on the Jumbotron at a Royals game. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman. And yes, we will be chatting at the end of the show about the most famous couple in the world and their connection to the baseball universe. But at the end, because we have much bigger fish to fry on this episode as we welcome a very special guest, literally Cal Ripken Jr., who played the most games in a row. Don't know if you heard about that. My baseball hero as a kid. He hopped on like a call and talked to us for 25 minutes. I still can't really believe it.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was like very shortly after the Taylor Swift news dropped, but we were able to collect ourselves and talk to someone that I know you've been looking forward to talking to for quite a long time. And it was a really, really cool opportunity, of course, with the 30th anniversary of him setting that incredible record coming up in early September. We got to chat with the Hall of Famer about it. And it's an awesome conversation. So looking forward to everyone hearing that. But we do have some other stuff to get to before we get to Mr. Ripken. Let's get to our opener.
Before the 2025 season comes to a close, we already have the 2026 schedule, which was dropped hours before trailer engaged one another. And the MLB schedule release does not have the significance nor the pizzazz of the NFL or even the NBA schedule release. That is because we have so many games, and nowadays every team plays every team. And so it's not like, oh, who we got this year? Oh, okay, cool. Oh, we're playing the Reds. Wow. Now, there are some interesting takeaways from what we received. Jordan, where would you like to begin?
Yeah, so I mean, each schedule, especially now where we've had, you know, a collection of jewel events and like special games to look forward to, obviously when the season has started overseas, that has been a significant part of the announcement. But in this case, there's nothing too out of the ordinary. I think a lot of the reaction to this year's schedule we can kind of get into in more of a macro sense, not about the specifics of who's playing where on certain holiday or certain celebration, but also just like what baseball schedules look like now. I mean, this will be, I guess, the fourth season of the balanced schedule that is coming up in 2026. And that is something that I know has attracted a lot of discourse. And even though it's not a new thing, I think seeing it once again in this press release format, and now that we've kind of gone through it a few years, I know that people have developed some pretty strong feelings about what it means for every team to play every other team and for every team to visit every city every other year, and what that does to kind of the experience of watching your favorite team, which is, of course, the experience for most fans, is they just care about what their experience is watching their favorite team. But before we get to that, I mean, well, obviously MLB is going to highlight some certain things that are different about the 2026 schedule than others. Most notably, we have a very early opening day. In fact, we have an opening night coming up next year between the Yankees and the Giants on Wednesday, March 25th, before the traditional opening day that we have grown used to kind of having on the Thursday where everybody plays. But little opening night action, whatever. You know, baseball, cool. I have to wait one fewer day for it.
Yeah. A bizarre choice, San Francisco, not because the Giants are weird and boring and perpetually mid, but it's probably going to be like pretty still cold there and windy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It would be that in New York, too. But
and the
that's
next
true.
Day,
that's true. Right.
Like March 25th is, it's maybe not the best representation. Like do that in a dome, you know?
Sure, sure. But we're going to deal with that for most of the March and April games anyway. I will say I am a little bit torn about Wednesday night because Wednesday, that Wednesday before opening day without the games, especially because we so often still even have like some spring training exhibitions on like the Monday and Tuesday as teams are leaving Arizona and Florida. Like that Wednesday is so much normally been a like, all right, let's take a breather.
Here we go.
And now we go. And now it's just like baseball, just we're going, you know, for the next six, 7 months.
Yeah, that Wednesday night
is nonstop. And not having that now is a little, I'm a little torn on that, to be honest.
I agree. I'm not asking for less baseball, but that's a, that's dinner with the spouse. That's, you know, we're going out, like we're cooking at an elaborate meal. This is our, the last hurrah of having free nights undistracted for many months. And I agree with you that I liked the structure of that before. Rivalry weekend is back May 15th to May 17th. All the rivalries are the same. None of those have changed, which is, we've bantered quite a bit about rivalry weekend. It's you. It's a good thing because we like rivalries. The one thing about rivalry weekend that's like whatever is I think spreading out the rivalries over the course of the season is good for people like us who watch all of the games because you kind of lose some of them in that weekend. Whereas over the course of the year, it's like, okay, this weekend, it's these two teams. That's great. I can lock in and I can watch that. What else do we have here? Jackie Robinson Day, Mets, Dodgers in LA will be very cool. The A's will be playing games in Las Vegas at the minor league ballpark, consecutive series in June against the Brewers and the Rockies. That will be very interesting to see like how the ballpark plays, first of all, and how Las Vegas reacts to having the A's there.
Yeah, I mean, so they played, they've already played some spring training games there since they've announced like we're coming to Vegas. That is one of the most hitter friendly ballparks in the minors. So, you know, maybe we'll see a bunch of home runs there. Here's an idea. Why don't we just play it on the active construction site? Just set up some, you know, set up some fences. We see this sometimes when new stadiums are being built. I have a very vivid memory of when Marlins Park was being built. They went in there and like took batting practice with like the construction essentially ongoing. Like I remember I like have this image of Marlins at that point just they must have told the construction workers like, hey, heads up, we're gonna be launching some baseballs here in this active construction site. Could you play a whole game? Probably not. But I do feel like we are going to have those photo ops at some point with you know, with Kurtz and Langoliers and Soderstrom just absolutely ripping balls over the cranes with the Vegas skyline. I think that's gonna happen at some point. There you go. Oh my god, look at that. We have Hanley that right Ramirez. Here. Hanley Ramirez. Oh, what an image. What an image. This is like with Marlins Park under construction 2011. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see this image, MLB Cathedrals on Twitter. Yeah, I remember that. I hope that they can replicate that for the Vegas. I don't know what the status of the ballpark will be at that point next summer, but I would love to see a version of that for the new Vegas ballpark.
One other little segment of the schedule that really made me laugh is what the Jays have to start. Did you see this? They go A's at home, Rockies at home, White Sox on the road, could be 11-0, and then immediate whiplash, Dodgers in town. But they're gonna have to get ready.
So here's what I'll say about this. I think in this specific case, I think it feels highly likely that what you are projecting is what is going to happen. That said, the degree to which people are reacting to some of the specifics of the schedule as if they know what month is going to be hard or easy based on how good your team's going to be, how good these other teams are going to be. Hey, guess what? If you looked at the schedule this time last year and you said, oh God, we have to play the Braves six times. Yeah, guess what? They stink. They stink. You don't have to worry about that because baseball is impossible to predict. The offseason has yet to come. All these players are going to change teams and people are going to get hurt. And some teams are going to suddenly decide to stink like the Twins. Like, trying to act like you know what any of this is going to look like for your team this far in advance is very, very, very silly. But also, part of the fun. So I'm not going to tell people how to react to the schedule, yes, but it is quite amusing to look at it and be like, oh, I know what that's going to be like. And listen, we talk about the schedule in the moment all the time because it feels a little bit closer. It feels a little bit more tangible. But this far in advance, it's hilarious to me to try and project strength of schedule.
The one other thing for next season is the World Cup, which is coming to North America. There are a number of games that are going to be rescheduled or moved around to accommodate for the World Cup. Now, that is just because many of these stadiums share areas, parking lots with the football stadium, presumably, that will be hosting games. I believe that is the case in Seattle. I believe that is the case in Philly. I think there's maybe one, or maybe Kansas City, I believe.
Kansas City and Texas.
A World Cup game. Okay. And so yeah, that's just Arlington
will have to deal with this. Yeah.
Our entire sporting world next summer is going to be World Cupified more than really ever before. And I am very surprised that MLB would schedule Dodgers, Yankees in New York the weekend of the World Cup final. Like, that World Cup final is going to be a night game, probably, right? So let's say it's like 7:30, 8 o'clock Eastern at MetLife in Jersey.
Will it be, though? Because it's a global... I don't know, man.
People are waking up, brother. They're waking up. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's true. It doesn't really matter.
And it's going to draw.
That's like, true. People are watching it. It doesn't really matter what it is. So if you're just worried about TV, then I guess.
Sure. I'm just saying baseball shouldn't like bend over backwards for every last sporting event. But it just feels like an odd time to put the two most popular teams by a mile playing one another in the city where the World Cup final is going on. Like, do you think that the Dodgers Yankees, obviously, in any other circumstance, would be the Sunday night game, right? And for all we know, the Sunday night game could be on like Tubi or, you know,
right?
Like, we don't know. I understand. But do you think that the Dodgers Yankees will go toe to toe with the World Cup final on Sunday night?
World Cup is going to be the World Cup final is going to be on Roku Sunday leadoff. I don't know.
You get one broadcaster, you do one broadcaster from Argentina and like one from Germany and
Oh, unfortunately our play-by-play guy is from Argentina and he has to call this epic goal from who's on Germany now. Is Leroy Sané still playing? What's he up to? I don't know.
Don't hurt yourself.
I can't. My soccer references are probably very outdated at this point. Anyway, the point is that is a fair question. It is a fair question. The World Cup is something that, it's I think at the very least, baseball's like, yeah, okay, we acknowledge this is a little bit more important than our regular season games going on in Kansas City and Seattle and Texas and so on. But that is an interesting wrinkle. Of course, we will have the All-Star game in Philadelphia, which will be a great old time. Yeah.
One dynamic with the World Cup being here, we are going to get so many international soccer players throwing out first pitches at games because of the way that the World Cup schedule is like staggered, and they'll be in all these big cities while these baseball games are like going on. Like, we're going to see freaking Ghana roll up to a Marlins game, and like, so we're going to have like over under 7.5 soccer superstars throwing out first pitches.
Yeah. Which is an important category of other athlete throwing out first pitch because it's soccer. And so the upper body coordination, and all, this is also even more true when you see, you know, putting Mbappe in the cage. It's a fascinating watch, right? It's like, man, these guys are world class, but they can't do anything if you put a, you know, a Marucci in their hand. So I don't know. We'll see. That's a great call. So now I'm just thinking about other World Cup implications of the schedule. Anyway, I will say too, but besides the specifics, as you mentioned, some of these things we're used to. We'll see if other Jewel events get announced. I know the Field of Dreams game we've mentioned. I assume and hope the Little League Classic will be back, although I'm not sure if that's been fully confirmed. But I did want to have at least a brief conversation again about just the concept of the balanced schedule and how people have started to react to it. Because I know you had a tweet that definitely resonated with some folks. Also, people some disagreed with. We've gotten a couple emails about this. We got an email from Jonah about this, who basically made the point, like, listen, like, I hear the perspective of that, yes, the bigger markets are seeing the Dodgers, Padres, and Yankees, Red Sox more often is good. But we have to think about the other teams and what was the point of it to begin with. Because the reason why I wanted to bring this up is the premise of your tweet, which I don't totally disagree with, but I think it's important to get at it, yeah. Which is the concept of fairness versus why we did this in the first place. Was the balanced schedule about so that everyone is playing everyone, so that the strength of schedule is in theory more balanced than oh, you're lucky, you're in the AL Central, you get to play all these crappy teams all the time, or whatever that happens to be the case this year? Or is it what, you know, Manfred has kind of said and has been presented as, which is we want everybody in every city to be able to see all the best players come through their city every 2 years. What is most important? I see it both ways. It's all part of it. And I think that I do think, as Jonah points out in his email, and as you point out too, like, when these series happen is as much having to do with the perception 100%. And the experience as much as how often they happen. And I think that is kind of where I lie, because I am definitely more pro-bound schedule than I think you are. But I do think that there has to be a way to, especially in the second half, maintain the stakes and the excitement of watching the division rivalries, you know, really unfold when the games feel like they matter more.
And it's tough, right? Because so the balanced schedule as an idea for fairness, I couldn't give a crap. And I know people in front offices in certain divisions are happy with this setup when you're in the AL East and it's like, thank God, like, we don't have to pay the Red Sox six times, we play them four, right? That's generally a positive for those types of teams. I do think it is a good thing that if you live in a city, you get to see the players every 2 years. You really, and I think that is meaningful. I think in the day and age where those games are on TV, it's a little different. It's less important because if I'm a huge Bobby Witt fan living in Miami, like, I know it's not the same, but I can watch Bobby Witt every night on MLB TV. Like, I don't need to wait for him to come to town. Whereas those matchups extend the rivalries extend beyond being at the game. Now, if you're gonna, one idea would be like, let's backload all the division matchups to the second half in a way, right? So you could have guaranteed, you know, Red Sox, Yankees, Dodgers, Padres down the stretch. I think that's a good thing. But then you have the situation, you've tweeted about this too, where it's like the Cardinals and Cubs, right, didn't play until June or something. Yeah. And that's bizarre. Yeah. And I just think that if we're going to give teams, like, if you winning your division should mean something. And I think beating that record that you end up with should be more weighted on how you do within the division. And I think adding more games within your division makes that more representative and captures the spirit of that a little bit more. Now, I know this is all going to be torpedoed in 3 years when we have realignment. I get it. But well, I just
probably
think
more than 3 years, but yeah.
Yeah. I just think having those high market games down the stretch is a good thing for the sport. I just do.
Yeah. No, I think that's totally fair. And the last thing I'll say on this is, right, if we could have a way to just spread it out more. I mean, it's not even that they're not playing in September. It's that we concentrated these Dodgers-Padres games over the course of 2 weeks in June and then 2 weeks in August. And again, there's so many logistical things that go into making this schedule. Totally. So it's easy for us to sit here and be like, hey, just make it this way. Why don't you do that? At the same time, if clearly they have found a way to change the schedule in a very significant way. And there's clearly still more upside to be had in the way that they structure it, even if the same allotment of games stays the same. And it is interesting, your point about the divisional, earning it in the division and what that means, because what you're describing is more of what we're kind of used to in college sports. And I don't know if we'd ever see that in baseball, where it's like, all right, yeah, you know, you went 18-12 in the SEC, you won the SEC, even if you have a worse overall record than a team that's, you know, 16-14, right? Like, that is something we're used to in college baseball. Honestly, if we're talking, that is in some ways, it's, you could argue, is trying to achieve more fairness to some degree. But I think that's really interesting, and I wonder how fans feel about that. I'm sure it probably varies for each division. And the other part about it is, all this things is cyclical. This goes back to my point about trying to project what the schedule is going to mean even a year out, is we assume that these are the rivalries that are going to be the most important ones forever, but that's just not always true. I mean, yes, we can assume that Dodgers Padres the way with these ownership and Red Sox Yankees, but Cardinals Cubs we would have assumed was going to be more important for a lot for longer. And if we had built the schedule around Cardinals Cubs, then, you know, that would have now ended up looking like flop, and it's more Cubs Brewers.
Sure, so, but I think that some of those things are kind of tough. The final month, ensuring that you basically play every division team once in the final month.
I think that's a great point.
Like, I know that that's hard because you have five teams, it's an odd number, and there's some that would be difficult. You should play everybody, not home and home, right? But like, every team should play every division rival once in the last month to guarantee that you have that. That's my suggestion.
I think that's a very, very simple fix that could be. It sounds simple to us, at least. Again, I know there's a lot of complications with how these schedules work. But all that said, there is one more part of the schedule that we have to talk about. This is something that I can't believe I have held off in watching up until this point. But now, while releasing the baseball schedule because it is much longer is different than when the football teams get to announce their schedules of 17, how many games do they play now? I don't know, but it's a lot smaller number. And so NFL teams get to get really creative with how they announce their schedules, like they, because they can really lean into just that small number of games. For baseball, it's a little bit more challenging, but we have seen increased creativity in recent years about how teams choose to announce the schedule. And this year was no different. But this time, for the purpose of this podcast, we are going to zoom in on the Detroit Tigers, who have gifted us with something that we have referenced so many times on this show, which is a Tigers anthem courtesy of Detroit rapper G-Mac Cash. Tigers Won Again, which he came out with last year during their Tigers epic run as a kind of a follow-up to Lions Won Again. We are huge G-Mac Cash fans, and my understanding is we have a new version of Tigers Won Again that has been released alongside the 2026 Tigers schedule. Jake and I have not watched this yet, but I have been thinking about what could be referenced in this song since I saw it 24 hours ago. And we are now going to watch it here, and we are going to give our takeaways.
Before we begin, over under 4.5 Tiger players referenced.
4.5?
We'll say Tiger players and employees, so we can include like Scott Harris or
Benetti?
Chris Fetter,
Benetti?
Jason Benetti. Okay. Ready with Benetti.
I think I'm going to go under. I think they're going to lean into just some of the opponents and just like, I think it's going to be G-Mac Cash talking about the Tigers, you know, kicking the Royals' ass and kicking the Guardians' ass and kicking the Twins' ass. Like, that's my guess as to what this will be. But let's find out.
Wow. Over the Jake over Mintz. Hits. Let's just
Jake
start
Mintz,
there.
The over hits. not only does the over hit, we have references to players that like probably aren't on the 2026 Tigers.
GT, Gleyber Torres is a free agent.
I mean, that is G-Mac Cash breaking news that Gleyber Torres is signing an extension after, I know he's been a lot worse lately, but this is incredible. Will Vest, bulletproof vest, love that. That's a huge win for him. We got a Kerry Bonds reference for Kerry Carpenter. We've got like what they going to do with Javi? Love that. That's great. So
we got which pitchers rhyming with food court, like Torque. I think it's like Torque hits it to the food court.
Scooble and Will Vest are our only, this is a tough look for Jack Flaherty, for Casey Mize, for honestly, like Tyler Holton, who, you know, if he had repeated the season that he had last year, I mean, Will Vest is, and honestly, Will Vest earned it, right? Because when you look at pitching chaos from last year and you say like, all right, this is a magical run for this pitching staff. How is this going to sustain or repeat in 2025? And the answer is it really hasn't. A lot of these guys have taken big steps backward, but Will Vest has absolutely sustained and he has earned himself a GMAT cash reference. I'm a little disappointed we did not get a Zach McKinstry ZMAT cash reference. But yeah. I'm not going to get too greedy.
So as far as my notes here show, we have Riley Green. Okay. We have Scooble. We have Torque. We have GT, Gleyber Torres. We have GT, Javi Baez.
Yep.
Yep. This is an amazing one. We have Kerry Bonds. We have Dylan Dingler.
Oh, I missed that one.
He goes Dylan on the catch. Right after Kerry Bonds, there's a clip of Dylan Dingler throwing down the second. There's a very small clip, but Dylan Dingler is definitely
Dylan
in here.
On the catch. Oh,
Dylan
my
on the catch. Dingler. Oh. Okay. And then you have one more Scooble, and then you have Will Vest. Wow. I mean, that is everything I could have dreamed of.
This really feels like GMAT cash. Here's some main character energy from us here. This feels like GMAT cash heard us give the, we've referenced the song so many times, but when we first talked about it, we were like, come on, man, like let's get some names in there. Let's get some references. Let's get some players. Like let's see that, you know, ball, Mr. Cash. And I got to say,
bulletproof
vest. The guy knows ball. Bulletproof vest. Holy crap. That fired me up. All right. Well, I'm going to be listening to that all day. And again, just for those of you who haven't watched it or just essentially they're just kind of sprinkling in the series as like graphics. It's not like he's talking about like, oh, we're going to Minnesota in August, which is fine. I'm sure when he was writing this song, he was like, yeah, I'd rather make references to guys named Vest. Any other takeaways? Who else got snubbed? Again, like Gleyber Torres is a pretty amazing inclusion considering we're talking about 2026. But
I would
anyone
say Kevin McGonigal and Max Clark.
Oh, I think Max Clark's got to like, yeah, that's true. I think you could have referenced
I would
the
also
top
say
tier farm system.
Biggest snub is AJ Hinch, I think. The skipper.
I agree. Unless it was in there and we missed it, I think that that's correct because
we got
AJ
Hinch
is honestly like more likely to be there than any of these guys in multiple
Way
seasons.
More.
So, yeah, that's a great point. Tough luck. I mean, again, missed opportunity for our guy, Matt Vierling, Parker Meadows. I know he's been injured. So I'm interested to, I think I'm definitely going to see the Tigers in September and probably October. So I look forward to talking to them about how this song has been received and if they, any of them feel snubbed or especially proud. And there you have it. The Tigers won again. All right.
Let's talk to Cal Ripken.
let's talk to Cal Ripken Jr. A weird transition, but obviously this is a very fun conversation. Do you need to intro it anymore? I mean, no, this is really cool. I mean, people who have listened to us and obviously know Jake's background and Baltimore familial connections knows that this is a very cool thing for reasons that will become very clear as we talk to Cal Ripken. So you don't have to tell that part again here, but any other big picture thoughts before we kick it to Cal?
The ceremony that the O's are doing for 2-1-3-1 on September 6th, it was funny. Someone at the Orioles was telling me about it. I was like, what day? And they were like, are you dumb? I was like, yeah, that was a bad question. September 6th, Saturday night against the Dodgers. I think the Camden Yards is going to be bopping, so that'll be really cool. All right, here is our conversation with Cal Ripken Jr. after a break. welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are delighted and overjoyed to be joined by a very special guest, a gentleman who played a handful of baseball games in his career, Cal Ripken Jr. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Yeah, a handful of games. I guess the final number was 3,001, and I always laugh damn near all of them in a row.
I went back and, you know, prepping to talk to you, I went back and watched some of the interviews you were doing around the time of 2131. And, you know, something that made me laugh was when Chris Berman asked you on the day if you thought you were going to be in the lineup. Do you remember this?
Yeah. I had that. There was a couple other similar kind of asked. Yeah. Am I going to have somebody cut up my food on the days leading up to it so I don't have a knife accident? You know, so anyway, what was another one? It might have been People Magazine at the time. Asked me if there was something about soap on a rope so that you wouldn't slip on soap in the shower.
Oh, so no shower injuries.
Yeah, the ultimate bubble wrap situation. Like, we got to make sure you're making it to that special
for
day.
For sure.
So for those of you listening who are not enormous Orioles fans, we are coming up on the anniversary of 2131, the all-time record for consecutive games played that Cal broke in 1995. And so just very quickly, Cal, my story with this is I was born the day before, 9/5/95, September 5th, 1995. My whole mom's side of the family is from Baltimore. And my grandmother left my mother in the hospital to go to the game. She had tickets. And she said, I have grandkids. I will have more. But I have season tickets. And I have lived in Baltimore my whole life. And I'm not missing this. And I was born at like 5:45 p.m. And there's a picture of me like in front of the TV as you're looking at 2130. And my question for you is, like, I'm sure you've heard many stories like this over the years, right? The way that people connect to what you accomplished. Are there any of them that stand out where you're like, wow, that is a great little tale. That is a great nugget of how 2130, 2131 connected with someone.
I wish I had one really great story, but a lot of them are similar to what you're describing right now. Is that September 6th, they were born on September 6th, and people took great pride that they were born and either had the game on in the hospital or kept going out, looking at it, and coming back. So I've met a lot of people. It's been a long time now. It's the 30th year anniversary. So it is a great pride that people take that were born either on September 5th or September 6th. I joke with Eddie all the time is that Eddie hit his 500th home run on September 6th, 1996. So every time it comes up, I send him happy anniversary. and he says, yeah, you had to overshadow my 500th home run.
Very selfish.
But, you know, I don't know. I guess you get philosophical in your old age. You try to figure out why it was so important to a lot of people. And I think that people really relate to loving something and showing up for it every day. You know, I wasn't one that had a perfect attendance in school. Matter of fact, I think my parents, and sometimes I believe that you needed a day or two to get back on track sometimes, where you would stay home and you really weren't sick, but you stayed home so you could catch up. But many people went to work for 30 years or 35 years or 40 years in an assembly line. Or my favorite one was Ernie Tyler. The Tylers around Baltimore. Ernie Tyler was the umpire attendant. And he didn't miss a game for 31 years, come to the ballpark every day. And he broke his streak when on my induction ceremony in 2007. So I just think it's interesting. I've enjoyed hearing people's stories about that. So it must be a value. It must be a principle that we all care about and that we relate to. You might not be able to relate to somebody throwing 100 or somebody that can hit a baseball and hit 100. You certainly can relate to an attitude or persistence or perseverance that you do in your own lives.
Yeah.
I think that the thing that I was really curious about, because now as we come up on the anniversary and there'll be so much celebrating that specific day and how that day went, and we're going to get into that with you too, but I want to talk about the years leading up to it, because for me, you know, looking back on it, it's not like you woke up that day on September 6th and you're like, oh my God, I'm about to set this record. Wow. Where did this come from? You know, but at some point, like at what point did this become a thing? Because that's a long time to be building up to it. Obviously, going into that season in 95, it was very much on everyone's people's minds. But how many games did you have to play in a row before people actually really did take notice?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I can give you a sort of a timeline. I got to the big leagues, just before my 21st birthday. I turned 21 later that month. I got called up. I played every day in my rookie year. Became the rookie of the year, played every day in my second year. We won the World Series, so rookie of the year, and I won the MVP, and we won the World Series in the first 2 years. And so I was just learning to play the position, learning how to, what my potential could be. So you kept going out there and playing, and the managers just kept writing my name in the lineup, and I was responding. And I would guess about 800 or 900 games, people started to take notice of it. I mean, I guess that's, 5 years worth? And during that time frame, I think during that 5 year period, I played in every inning of every game.
Yeah.
And, but never gave it a thought. Nobody ever thought about, is this thing good? Is this thing bad? Is it harmful to them? I was just going out and playing, and the managers wrote my name in the lineup. It wasn't until we got close to the National League record, they started taking notice of it. And then, Ebert Scott was like 1306. And then he was second to Lou Gehrig. Lou Gehrig's number was so far in advance that nobody really thought about it. But the Orioles went into a rebuilding mode, in and around that time frame. A lot of challenges. Every time it seemed like I went into a slump or the team wasn't playing well, there was sort of a negative feeling towards the streak. That Cal should take a day off. He's being selfish. All he cares about is himself. He should, for the sake of the team. But all I did was show up with the same attitude that I did when we were winning in those times, yeah. And saying, you want to play. And the manager has to sit in his office and decide who can meet the challenge of the day, and they write your name in the lineup. So I never believed in it. Sometimes I kind of resent the fact that you had to defend yourself, that you wanted to play. Because there's some people that, if they didn't want to face the pitcher that was pitching that particular night, it was very tough on them, they might come up with a mysterious illness or a injury like a day or two before, so they don't have to face that person. I always thought that person should have to defend himself, why totally. He wasn't playing. But then it got to a point probably around 16 or 1700 games, maybe 1800, where everybody turned positive. All my critics turned, they jumped on the side and said, this is the greatest thing for baseball. Cal's got to break this record. There was collective bargaining issues and labor issues,
right?
Yeah. Around that time, and I think that that everybody thought it would be good for baseball if we focused on that at the time. So it was all happy. Then even after the record was broken in 1995, I continued playing 500 more games after that, and we were really good in 96 and 97, and. And if there was one moment that I think I was selfish in the whole streak thing, it was in 97. I herniated a disc in my back in July. And I'm thinking, we're the best team in the league from the opening day till now, and I'm not going to miss out on this. So I asked the doctor, I said, look, if I can get through the pain, would I do any permanent damage to myself? And he said, no, I don't think you will. So I gave it a try. I wasn't going to miss out on being on a good team.
Yeah. But it's funny that there was criticism in like 1991. You guys win 67 games. The difference in you taking a day off and not taking a day off is not going to transform the 1991 Orioles into like this perennial, this contending ball club. So I think that dynamic is really interesting. I want to zoom in on September 6th, 1995 for a second, because one of my favorite nuggets from the story is you taking your daughter to kindergarten, right?
Yeah.
Because I think your appeal and why people gravitated towards what you accomplished was in large part because it was very relatable, right? It was, you went to work every day. And here you are on the morning where you are the most famous person in America on that day doing the most normal human thing that someone can possibly do, drop their kid off for their very first day of school. So my question for you is, what do you remember about that specific interaction of getting in the car in the morning, driving to the school, dropping her off, and driving home?
It's amazing is that just came up with my daughter about a week ago. She was trying to figure out a way to come back. She's got a pretty demanding job out in Colorado. And she was saying, Dad, I can't make it back for the 4-hour anniversary, she used to call it. And then I said, it's kind of cool looking back on September 6th and breaking the record and all that. She goes, I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about my 30th anniversary of you taking me to school, my first day of school. And I remember I was pretty exhausted during that time. It was like there was a lead up. There was a finish line. There was giving extra time as best you could.
You're not sleeping much.
And I had a little bit of a fever. I was not feeling really well. So you're not sleeping really well. But it was really important to get up and take your daughter to a first day of school. And I'm glad she remembers it that way. I'm glad that she looks back on it. It was our time. I got some ink in the paper, and she got a mention, which she never really liked the attention that the name brought to her. But in this particular case, she was proud of it. So
did you take her into the school, or did you drop her off in front? Like, were there people swarming your car? Like, what was that environment like?
No, early on, the first day of school, you want to make sure you haven't really got the carpool thing down at her school.
And you had never done carpool. This was your first carpool experience as a dad, right?
I did walk her in, just to make sure everything was all right. And she was good, that she felt good. Yeah. But she's always really independent. So that was a really cool thing. And I do remember there were some times when she asked me and during carpool whether I could pick her up like down there a little bit or up there because I was getting attention in carpool line.
But, can you imagine your daughter's...
For the most part.
Being your daughter's kindergarten teacher and like you walk in on September 6th night, like you don't, you're like, oh, this girl Rachel is on the list and like she could be a good... And you just walk into the room. It's like mind-blowing.
So she was all girls school and we were in the news a lot. So, I mean, it was definitely a big deal. But I remember things like this, I would pull up to pick her up sometimes in the carpool and I'd open up the sunroof window and I'd stand on the seat and yell Rachel across the way so that all her friends would see her. And then she goes, Dad, stop. And I took great fun and pride in doing that. Normal fun things like that.
You weren't ducking the attention. You were using it as a weapon to, make your daughter uncomfortable in the funniest possible way, which is, that's great. That's extremely relatable. So again, there's so many elements of that day that we could dig into. The one element we wanted to get into is the lap. And the thing about that we wanted to ask about is because, as you mentioned, there's so much attention leading up to that day and the stuff before the game and the actual game and all these things, that when this game stops and you take a lap around the stadium, which I know was not your idea, but you were kind of pushed into doing, that sense of...
Literally.
Literally pushed into doing. That sense of those actual face-to-face interactions in a stadium and in a city that has meant so much to you, are those vivid memories? Were you seeing people that you had known and seen in the crowd for years? Like, how much did that kind of shrink the experience that had obviously become this nationwide phenomenon?
Yeah, there's two things. Catching the last out of the World Series is the greatest moment I ever had on the baseball field. It's part of your dream as a kid. It feels great. It's you've achieved the ultimate. The best human moment on the baseball field was that moment in 21-31, and specifically the lap around the stadium. I remember I was embarrassed by the curtain calls, and they were clapping for 20-some straight minutes. And I kept saying, thank you, thank you. And in my heart, I was thinking, okay, it's like a rain delay now. The pitchers need to stay warm. We need to stay ready to play. We got four more innings we got to play. And then I'll celebrate however you want. So my attitude was kind of that. Thank you, thank you. Let's get the game going on. And Rafael Palmeiro came up with the idea, you're going to have to take a lap around this ballpark before we get the game started again. I go, that's a dumb idea. I'm not doing that. And then it happened once or twice. And then Bobby Bowen, he got some reinforcements. Bowen and him pushed me down the line. And then I thought, okay, I shook Al Bumbry's hand. I went down. And I first was thinking, well, maybe we'll just run around fast and get this over with. But then once you started looking into everyone's eyes, there were people I knew by name. There were people I knew by face. They had been there all along. It was such a good experience. I started shaking hands. Somebody reached over the right field fence, and they tried to reach down and touch my hand, and they fell all the way to the bottom. And I thought they fell all the way to the bottom, but the bottom was just three quarters of the way up to the fence, so they just popped up real quick, which surprised me. But by the time I got to that point, I could care less if the game ever started again.
Yeah.
You know, it was that sort of an experience, and he came around. Especially meaningful talking to the California Angels, and one in particular was Rod Carew. When I finally watched the video of myself doing that, I saw the interaction with Rod Carew, and I was thinking, man, that was really cool, but I don't remember what was said, you know, at that point. But I do remember leaving him and saying that was really cool. And then he got a chance to show my kids the T-shirt that I wore underneath my uniform. It said 2,131 hugs and kisses for Daddy. And so at that point, the game, you know, became secondary, and it was just one of those great personal human moments, because the celebration that was so big went down to a very personal level, almost one-to-one.
To actually touch people's hands and build that connection. I want to ask about after the game, because it's a whirlwind. You play the game, you win the game, you go yard. They rolled Joe DiMaggio out there and no one knows who's going to be there. Like, that is, we could talk about that for an hour. But then afterwards, you do all the media. You talk, I think you did an interview with Bob Costas. What point, what time was it when you were able to sit down and like crack a beer and exhale?
Yeah, I was having the shakes by that time. I hadn't had my beer yet. I think it was exactly, I remember sitting down with Bob Costas, and it was like 2:30 in the morning. So it was that late when I actually started the interview. It felt good because there was a sense of relief. I mean, quite honestly, after 21:30, you know, it was a foregone conclusion that the 21:31 was going to happen. And so that was a sense of relief. But up until that point, that was the first time I ever felt any pressure during the streak. I always thought, whatever happens, it's going to happen. I'll play. If I hurt myself or something happens during it, that's the way it was meant to be. But then all of a sudden, everybody's planning for the celebration. And all of a sudden, I think, man, I got to get to a finish line. And I didn't like that feeling. But at the end of the game, I was exhausted. I was tired. We had an off day the next day, which we had a parade. That we went around almost like it's a World Series. And then when I went on to Cleveland, it was really cool that I took the lineup cards up, for that game. And Eddie Murray brought the lineup cards up, for the Indians. And that was a really cool moment as well. So tons of really cool moments. But, I was exhausted. The stimulation of people and trying to and you got to remember too, we had a strike in 94. They canceled the World Series in the end of 94. We had a lockout to start that season, and so a lot of us were feeling, bad that we took the product away from the fans, and we were all trying to do extra, and that was a factor in the whole streak as well. But by the end of 21:31, I was exhausted.
Do you remember what type of beer it was, and like who gave it to you, and like where it came from?
What kind of beer?
Yeah, I just, to me, because when you like clean out your garage, or you mow the lawn, and you crack that beer, and it just tastes you move someone into somewhere, and you crack that beer open, and it's just like, it tastes better than any other beer you've ever had in your life. I could just the 2-1-3-1 beer must have just been the most satisfying, gratifying, like sound and smell and taste. It's such a great little nugget.
So I was a beer drinker. And yeah. Sometimes I got made fun of when I wouldn't work out after the game. I'd have a small little cooler and you have an ice slush bucket with you.
Yeah.
And you throw a couple beers in there. And in between reps, you'd be actually sipping on a beer.
Yeah. I've done that.
So, and the times when they would go down really, really fast and easy, which sometimes are dangerous when that happens to you, but we'd always call that, it went down like a creamsicle. And so I would say the 21-31, first beer I cracked after that, it was a creamsicle.
That's a
good way to put it. Cal, my last question for you is kind of more big picture about the premise of this streak and being an Ironman and playing in every game and how you have kind of observed that since then in the modern game. And you know, I'm not asking you to come and be like, oh, I can't believe these guys aren't playing 2000 games in a row. You know, that's not what I'm expecting. But at the same time, you know, it is uncommon for players to play 162 games nowadays. Matt Olson currently has a very impressive streak of over 750 games that's active, but that's of course a ways off from yours. So not that you maybe have you expected anyone to catch you or ever will, but what do you make of just like that as a concept of playing every day and that we don't see it as often anymore?
Well, I mean, the definition of an everyday player has changed a little bit now. The expectation is not for you to play 162. In my day, everyday player meant playing every day. If you think about it, you have a 162 game schedule, and especially now with the wild cards, it can boil down to one game. And it did in my first year. We were tied after 161 with Milwaukee Brewers, and we lost game number 162 and didn't make it. So we were asking ourselves, where could we have made up that one game in, you know, April, May, June? You know, we could have gone to the World Series. We could have won. And so I think each game is as important as the next game. So that was always my approach and my attitude. I did run into Matt Olson on spring training this year. We were in the same restaurant. And he took particular pride at playing every game. And I liked seeing that in him. I also liked, I think, Brady Anderson and B.J. Surhoff, teammates of mine during that time. I think they each completed one season of playing 162, and they had their best seasons. And that took it felt really good to me that they pushed themselves, you know, to find out that they could do it. I don't hold any expectations. I don't begrudge anyone. I always thought when I got an injury, got nicked up a little bit, there was something positive that was going to happen, that I was going to, my swing was going to get better. I hyperextended my elbow one time, and I couldn't really swing in the on-deck circle. And I went up to home plate, and I gingerly swung a slider in the dirt, and I winced in pain. Trainer comes running out and says, you know, what's up? And I go, I heard it on the slide, you know, 2 innings ago. And I go, and he kind of pushed on it and said, well, then stop broken. You know, I don't know if, you know, anything's wrong. I said, okay, I'll try it. So I waited on the next pitch, which was a fastball, up in the strike zone a little bit. And I waited to put a short swing on it and hit a line drive one hopper at the second baseman. And as I was running to first base, the realization came over me that says, when you swing and miss, it hurts like hell. When you make contact, it doesn't hurt at all. And I got to tell you, I got so hot, you know, average-wise and home run-wise. And it's a simple thing. Maybe you focus a little better. Maybe you shorten your swing up. Maybe you don't try as hard. And it actually proved to be a better thing. So having experienced a couple of those things, every time that I got nicked up or something, I would always think that there's a silver lining in here somewhere.
My last question for you is about transitioning into the real world, for lack of a better term. Now, I know you've been on the outside now longer than you've been on the inside. Your post career has been longer than your playing career. For someone whose entire life was built around routine, how did you go about finding that peace and that rhythm once the game, from a physical perspective, was removed from your life?
Yeah. I tried not hard. I tried really hard to focus on doing stuff as opposed to thinking about it. In my first year out, they left for spring training without me. You know, it was almost like you had the off season. It would seem normal all the way up until spring training. And then all of a sudden you look up and they go to spring training and you're not there. And you start to think, hey, they left me. They left without me. But I was so busy trying to buy a minor league team. I was on the hook for building a new stadium in my hometown without a team, but I had to do all these things to try to buy a team, move it from the New York Penn League into or you move it from one league into our league. I had to go through territorial issues. And so I focused my attention on being busy. And I chose to not stay in professional baseball because I wanted to be there for my kids more. My kids were 8 and 12 when I retired. So I wanted to kind of see them through high school. So you dive into baseball. I mean, minor league baseball at the time was my first to jump into business. It was a familiar product. You learn about it and you make mistakes. You do whatever. But we were successful. We started a really successful kids business. At first, we were funding it a whole lot more than we should have. But then we figured out the model where it could make money and do all that kind of stuff. But recently, you know, joining the ownership group now, being pulled back in, David Rubenstein called and asked me to join the group. I feel myself being on the inside again. I'm being pulled back in to the highest level of baseball. It's changed a lot. A lot of analytics kind of lead the way. But there's still always room for good baseball judgment and good baseball know-how. And I think that I can be helpful on the second part of that. But I'm learning about the analytics. But it feels really good to be on the inside looking out again.
Yeah. Living and dying with the results, right? Like that's wins, losses, right? Like that's what it's about. Thank you so much for your time. And then, you know, I'm sure you hear this all the time, but as someone who grew up in the DC, Maryland area and, you know, went to Camden Yards when I was one, who one of the things behind me is these Coke bottles, Coca-Cola bottles here with you across them. And, you know,
I have a bunch of those. I wouldn't drink the Coke out of them.
Right? No, I won't. I will not.
Staying close.
I will not. I will not. Maybe 50th anniversary of 2131. I'll crack one.
There you go. I'll pop crack one open together. It's like good wine.
Yeah,
Definitely.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly. For sure. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for being an inspiration and for making baseball, this beautiful world that so many of us love, matter and have weight to so many people. So thank you for that and thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's do a little field report. So this was a very cool event that I was fortunate to do. The Women's Professional Baseball League, a league that is booting up next season, had open tryouts this weekend here, very luckily for me, in Washington, D.C., The tryouts were held from the 22nd to the 25th. Those first 3 days were at Nats Academy. They had over 600 women try out for the league. That was pared down to about 100 women for the final day of games at Nats Park where there were scrimmages. That was open to the public. And this was just so cool. It was just so freaking cool to see. Now, obviously, for many people, the touch point for women playing baseball is a league of their own. And I think if you listen to this podcast, you know that we have talked a lot about, we love softball. It is something that entertains us and is a wonderful sport all its own, but that girls and women should be empowered and have the opportunities to play baseball if that's what they want to do. And setting up this league as something that hopefully one day can be commercially viable to give that end point for the journey of young girls playing baseball is just stupendous. I wrote about it over at Yahoo. You should go read that. And I would say that my biggest takeaway, having coached in Little League and coached girls in Little League, is that you often see that kids, like being the only girl on a team, obviously not something I've ever experienced, but I've seen it from the coaching perspective. Being the only girl on the team forces the kids to carry something extra when they come to the field. They always feel like they need to prove themselves. And that manifests both like on the field during practice and in social situations, right? And that's not to say that women and girls shouldn't have the opportunity to play against dudes if they want to, and if they have those opportunities and if they can hang, like that's a good thing. It's just that like talking to the women who are at this event and many of them saying, I have never played a baseball in a baseball environment before where everyone was a woman, and that was empowering and almost like released a different type of energy and joy. And I talked to some of the parents, this wasn't in my story, but I talked to some of the parents of the girls that I used to coach, one of whom recently got involved in Baseball for All, which is Justine Siegel's organization that like provides travel ball type opportunities to girls who want to play baseball. And like these parents are saying, yeah, when she goes out to play in these environments, it's a completely different situation and it's totally freeing. And so just to be around it and see it, one of our pals from childhood who we worked with at baseball camp growing up, whose brother was at my wedding, she tried out and like made the final day. And it was just so, like, so cool to see her thriving and succeeding in that space, and for it to be at Nats Park, right? Like, yeah, what an experience that was. But my biggest take, like, this is the beginning of something very cool, right? Now, where the team's going to be, where the game's going to be, how many people are going to play, how can you watch it? Like, that's all TBD. But I would say the league structure very much seemed like it had its crap together. And I'm very hopeful and very excited for what this turns into.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously, we've seen an explosion of women's sports at different sports in terms of popularity, of course, with yeah, basketball leading the way in a lot of senses. But softball as well has grown, and the pro leagues that we've seen in softball. And I think that's been exciting. I think what the biggest challenge, especially as we grow, as we see leagues like this grow in terms of not that viability commercially should be the most important thing, of course, like the opportunities to play, you have to start somewhere. It's not like you're suddenly expecting to be on TV all the time, but it's that, you know, even for softball, for those pro leagues, a lot of those players, young softball fans are familiar with because they play in the Women's College World Series. And there's an experience of like getting to know them as they become stars in college. Obviously there have just historically been fewer of those opportunities for young women who are playing baseball to become notable. And that's why people like Monet Davis are extremely important, because the Little League World Series has been the most obvious venue for girls at obviously at a young age to be playing baseball on a very, very big stage. And so that is why, and she, of course, I know she's involved in and around in this, and we've seen there was another girl who's there in Williamsport this year on the Australian team. We've seen almost one a year, basically, since Monet. So those are important, too. And that's the challenge, I think, that they face in terms of garnering that kind of casual interest that the other women's sports obviously already have. But that doesn't mean that it should be stopping the hope to build this up, because one day you hope that there are just women baseball players. It's like, yeah, that's someone that I'm a fan of.
The biggest impediment or disadvantage or difference between women's baseball and other women's sports is that there are no scholarships available at the college level. And so what ends up happening in the development pipeline is, if I'm a 14-year-old girl and I rake and I'm really good at this, well, why would I continue to play baseball when there is no clear pathway for me that's going to benefit me, when I can move over to softball and maybe get a big college scholarship and NIL to a Power Five, right? Yep. Like, that is
100%.
Whether it is like a cognizant decision or a conscious one, or it happens kind of more passively, it's a huge part of this. And so, not that this is how the league is, you know, its stated goal, but like having scholarships and opportunities available for college women's baseball, like, that is a huge component of this. So all in all, super cool. Go read. There's a bunch of stuff written about it. They're making a documentary about the experience. It was just really cool and frankly, really inspiring, because, like, I mean, more baseball, the better. Like, if you want to play ball at a high level, you should be able to do
we
that.
We want more leagues to follow. We're the first people. It's like, oh, great. You want to give us another league for us to keep track of? Sounds good to me. I obviously support that. But yes, go read Jake's story. A lot of good details and scene in there. All right. A few more topics. Let's go around the league.
The Mets pitching cheating lab has done it again. No, I'm kidding. The New York Mets have promoted Jonah Tong another top pitching prospect to the big leagues. He will make his big league debut on Friday in New York against the Miami Marlins. Jonah Tong is a fascinating character. And if he's good, he will be a big effing deal. Now, that is for a number of reasons. Jordan, let's start with the development story here, because it is very abnormal. And I think does an important job in explaining why Jonah Tong is significant.
Yeah, so we talked recently when we did our little prospect check-in about these Mets pitchers, and we speculated, all right, these guys are probably going to get called up soon because the Mets rotation is kind of a mess. We had Brandon Sproat, who still hasn't been called up. We had Nolan McLean. Those are guys that took very traditional paths. They were stars at the collegiate level. They were known for many, many years. Jonah Tong, quite different. This is a kid from Ontario, Canada, who before his senior year of high school was really not known by anybody. He was committed to play at North Dakota State, but his velocity started to tick up his senior year. This is in 2022. He transfers from his school in Canada to the Georgia Premier Academy, which is sort of like an athletic boarding school situation in Georgia, and he starts throwing harder. And at that point, it's like, oh, hold on a second. This guy might be able to get picked out of high school, but he was still relatively unknown because he hadn't been to very many events. He goes to the MLB Draft League as a high schooler in 2022. He has a 10 ERA, but he shows enough on the mound with a very interesting delivery, and you know, his stuff was pretty good, where it's like, all right, we have something here. But this is an incredible scouting job by the Mets, because not only did they sign him, they got him in the seventh round for under $300,000. Like, this is not someone that they had to overpay or give him $3 million and hope that he turned into something good. This was a find and a belief in the kid, in the athlete, that he could develop into something more than he was at that point. They were willing to take that risk. They knew that he was signable. That's another thing. You have to understand who you're kind of working with when you're talking about kids that age. And in 2024... he was unbelievable, but because it was so different looking and because he didn't have the track record going into this year, it was like, all right, like, the Mets have something here, but like, what is it really? And he just took another step forward this year to where I believe he's leading the minor leagues in strikeouts, has a 1.43 ERA, didn't allow a run in his two starts in AAA. He just turned 22 and it looks different. It's pretty much the closest thing we've had to a Tim Lincecum-esque delivery. He's not that small, but he's also not that big. He's 6'1 and pretty skinny. But man, oh man, like, at this point, you know, for how fast he's gotten this good, that's why you get excited about talents like this, because that's the kind of progression. And honestly, Nolan McLean's similar for a different reason, right? Because he ditched the two-way thing and suddenly became this awesome pitching prospect. You wrote about that recently too. Tong is just how fast he's gotten this good and has become this polished is remarkable. And now we'll see if he can meaningfully impact the Mets rotation, which I don't think the Mets were planning on asking him to do when the season started. But now here they are. They realize he is probably one of our best pitchers. And this is the Mets exhibiting a level of aggression and urgency that I think you have to commend. But we'll see how he does, because it is hard to be a good starting pitcher as a rookie. That's why Paul Skenes is so special. That's why even Jacob Mizrowski in a smaller sample, and it's been up and down with him. You can't count on him to be an immediate ace, but for what he's been able to overcome and what he's been able to prove already, I'm not really going to doubt this kid at this point. Two other quick topics, because we, you know, fortunately, lucky us, we get to go talk to baseball players as part of our job. And we did that this week, and I got to talk to Junior Caminero and watch Junior Caminero hit a couple more home runs in Cleveland against the team that originally signed him out of the Dominican Republic before he was traded in an unfortunate transaction for the Cleveland Guardians organization for Tobias Myers, who, of course, did not end up being anything. But watching Junior Caminero, who also just turned 22 and is now at 39 home runs, watch him hit two more homers on Monday, and just kind of wrapping my mind around the season that he is having and has had, and what to think about what he has already accomplished and what more he could do is pretty staggering and kind of kind of tough to really encapsulate, because he's now doing things that have not been done before for players this age. He's now doing things. He's heading for the franchise record in home runs. Carlos Pena, 2007 with 46. He's got 39. It's not September yet. And I don't know, when you are this productive this early in your career, it's hard not to dream pretty big. And yes, his on-base percentage is still way lower than you normally associate with top hitters in baseball. And in some ways, you could view that as an even more impressive thing, because most players who swing the bat this hard and have this much power are striking out a ton. And Junior Caminero is not doing that. He is not walking either, and that is a flaw in his profile. But what he's been able to do offensively this year, and how much better he's gotten defensively, especially in the second half, is what makes him on a very short list of just position players you would build around. I mean, we're not going to just go through that exercise now, but there aren't a lot of guys that you would pick over Junior Caminero right now as just a no doubt offensive force of nature. And it's just so, he's so much fun to watch do his thing, and cool to kind of see it up close this week.
Seems like a player the Guardians could use. Junior Caminero type guy.
Yeah, they could. They could use a few of those, I would say. But I don't think they're going to do a little redo on that.
Control
redo Z. On that deal. I don't think the Rays are going to give them back that one. So, but yeah, Junior Caminero, hell of a thing.
Junior Caminero for Jose Ramirez, who says no?
I think the Rays say no. I think Jose Ramirez says no, to be honest.
I think Junior Caminero also says no. Yes.
But I understand you also spoke to a good baseball player this week. Is that true?
Yeah, I talked to Garrett Crochet. The Red Sox were in Baltimore. They're still there. And Crochet is set to start on Thursday. I sat down and chatted with him for a little bit. I just think his development from injured reliever to no doubt top three pitcher, top four pitcher in the world is fascinating and singular. Remember, leading into 2023, leading into 2024, really hadn't thrown that much in the big leagues. Before last year, he had a grand total of 73 innings with zero starts. Okay, he blows out, gets Thomas Johnson, comes back, and the White Sox are like, hey, brother, you're going to start on opening day. And Jordan, you remember the two of us were like, what are they doing? Garrett Crochet on opening day? They're out of their minds. And then bang. Last year, pitches to a 3.58 across 146 innings. And the peripherals are indicating that this is one of the best pitchers in the world, but he's not necessarily collecting outs at that rate and exhibiting the dominance that everybody knows he's capable of. He's on something of an innings limit too, because he is almost limiting himself coming off TJ. He knows the White Sox suck. He's pitching for the worst team ever traded to the Red Sox. And one of the things that he said that was really interesting is, like, in signing the extension, he wanted to have the financial security so that he could just empty the tank, so that he was not worrying about his elbow and if it blew again, how would that impact his future? He was just like, now that I'm set, like, I'm going to throw nine if I can. I thought his at bat against Aaron Judge earlier this year was one of the more memorable showdowns we've had in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. How many dudes just face Aaron Judge four times? Like, that in and of itself is a special thing, to face Judge four times in a game. And so, yeah, it was just very interesting to talk to Crochet and hear a little bit about his process. And you can read that over at Yahoo later this week. All right. It has been a very busy show, but we have not talked about the biggest news on planet Earth. Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce engaged. And related to that, I have one dumb question. So these are the most famous coupled people on the planet right now. Athlete, superstar. My dumb question, Jordan, more famous, Travis and Taylor or Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe? You remember that I remember. You remember?
Yeah,
that.
Man. Oof. Absolutely. I remember when Marilyn went on Joe DiMaggio's podcast, and it was
yes.
like, oh my God, she doesn't with go Dom on DiMaggio. Podcasts.
Joe, right, Joe had the right. pod with his brother, Dom DiMaggio.
Exactly. It was called
Old Heights.
I bring that up as a joking intro to this premise because Taylor Swift, comparing this power couple to one from many decades ago is quite challenging to understand that, like, the world now is both much bigger and much smaller than it was then. I don't have a great sense for Marilyn Monroe's global fame at the time. I understand it existed for sure, but what that meant at the time, anyone's global fame at the time, right? What that actually, you know, means compared to, like, when Taylor Swift is selling out the biggest stadiums on the planet in every continent, that is more compelling than what Marilyn Monroe was probably the level that she was at. But there were also fewer celebrities at the time. So that's
yes.
that is the argument in favor of the Monroe DiMaggio combination. But I think at this point, I feel pretty comfortable saying that Taylor Swift has achieved levels that are basically unreachable sure. for anybody from many decades ago. And so I'm going to give the nod to okay. Mr. Cleveland Heights. And by the way, I drive past Travis Kelce's high school all the time now, and I'm just like, wow. That's crazy. As someone who's become more of a Taylor Swift fan over the last few years, I'm like, yeah, good, God bless, more content, so bring it on.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. Here's how I'm gonna do it.
Go team DiMaggio. Let's hear the defense. I'm ready.
Well, I'm gonna start with Monroe. I would say Monroe is the most famous woman of the 1950s, right?
All right.
The most famous woman of the 90s, of her peak, you know, I mean, we're talking mm-hmm. 10 more seasons there. I would say Taylor Swift is the most famous woman of her era, probably of even the 21st yeah. century so far. So not to cancel yeah. those two out, but they, in terms era adjusted, right? We're talking yeah. similar hemispheres of superstar. Okay. Now let's move to the men.
Global fame plus. That's what you're going
Global
by.
Fame plus. Let's move to the men. I think it's indisputable that Joe DiMaggio is a bigger star than Travis Kelce, removed from the coupling. Okay? Removed from the coupling. Joe DiMaggio is a top, what, 25, 40 player of all time?
Oh, whoa, no. You just changed the parameters there, my friend. You just changed the parameters, because if you're talking about where he ranks relative to his peers on his respective field, okay, maybe yeah. you're going to end up having an argument. But dude, it's football. What? Come on. What are we talking about? He's been playing
no,
on the team that's
no,
in the
no,
Super Bowl
no,
every year.
But it's
like, I just
wrong. It's football now. Okay, that so football now. The way that everyone cares about football
and
now.
And it's baseball then. I get it.
That's what baseball was yeah. in the 40s.
I know. Okay?
And we had
fine.
Joe DiMaggio. You can make an argument Joe DiMaggio was the most famous athlete of the decade, of the 1940s. Now, remember, he yeah. did not marry Marilyn Monroe yeah. until he retired. You know, that's forgotten history.
Big mistake.
But, like, is Travis Kelce the most famous athlete of the last decade? He's not even in the top 25.
But you're underrating what the association has done for him. So that's what I think.
Sure, but I think you should remove that.
But we're literally talking about them as a couple. So I think if the
argument
is...
No, but his association... okay.
You can't have both ways. What are we debating or not? The couple... If you want to just argue Travis Kelce versus Joe DiMaggio and pretend like their significant others don't exist, that's a funny, weird conversation to have. But
thanks.
That's not the premise you brought here today. So I think I am going to stick with Travis and Taylor. But I think it is interesting. I think it is an interesting comparison for a number of reasons. And I do feel like there are probably people. I don't know if there are people listening to this that are old enough to remember.
You guys remember, right?
Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe as a thing. That'd be awesome if you are. Let us know. BaseballBarbercast.
Email us.
Either way, whether you remember that or not.
Call us on a landline.
I do feel like people will have opinions about this, and I look forward to hearing from them. So let us know.
Are there any other athlete celebrity couples that are in the hemisphere of either of those two? Like, those are, I think, one and two by a mile.
Yeah, at this point, I don't. I mean, again, we've had some pretty good ones, but this is going to be a tough one to top for quite a long time. I don't know. I'm just like, again, like the first, okay. You just have to keep focus on like anyone being more famous than Taylor Swift anytime soon is difficult to fathom from just like that space. So it's quite the bar to beat.
There are two others, I think, in the modern era that deserve a hat tip. And that would be Dwayne Wade and Gabrielle Union, right? Hall of Fame player. Dwayne Wade's a Hall of Famer. Dwayne Wade's a Hall of Famer. Now, the one that is higher profile than that is David and Victoria Beckham.
Yes. That is a much more compelling one that you should have led with. That said, and soccer is a nice starter for sure. Really good.
He's the most famous.
David Beckham, he was the most famous soccer player in the world.
And hot. Sure.
But also in that case, he's doing the carry. I mean, I know Victoria Beckham was famous. She's famous too, but I still don't think it's there. But it's a good one. It's a better one. Our producers tell us to shut up because this is not the point.
And Sachin.
Shout out Cole Tucker. Saw him at the All-Star game. What a great guy. We're done. Thank you for listening to Baseball Barbercast. Thank you to Cal Ripken Jr. for joining us on a podcast in which we talked about Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce for 10 minutes. You can email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com and we will be back later this week. Reminder, folks, you can watch Baseball Barbercast, Yahoo Sports Network, our first ever streaming TV channel, Yahoo Sports Network, available to stream on all leading fast services, streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv, where you can catch all the shows on your phone or your browser. Most importantly, Baseball Barbercast. Thank you all for listening, watching, enjoying, and we'll talk to you all very soon. Bye-bye.